car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars coming to you, as always, from Strongbox West in Atlanta. It is a cold, crisp day outside. The sun occasionally peeks through, but we're glad to be here in a warm conference room in Strongbox West. Around the table today, we have...
Ben.
Ronnie.
Becca.
And I'm Mickey, as always. We've got a number of really cool things to talk about on the board. Let's just jump right into our agenda. Ronnie has brought up the topic of revisiting autonomous vehicles / new technology, the direction of new technology. Ronnie, what have you got in mind?
Yeah, so actually, this was something that I picked up on our last recording session that I didn't manage to express in fulfillment. From a previous episode, some of you may remember that my wife was on air with us, and we talked about a wreck that we got in during our drive from here in Atlanta all the way up to New Jersey. And it's a long drive. It's a very, very long drive. And one of the things that I discovered along the way was, you know, it's nice to have cruise control. After the wreck, we got into a 2018 Toyota Camry that was fully loaded with all kinds of options. And one of the options that I didn't get to experience firsthand yet was radar-assisted cruise control. So ultimately, the car can set a fixed distance between you and a front car. There is lane departure assistance, so not only does it warn you from you automatically weaving in lanes, it can assist you in keeping you straight in lanes, which is swell. But it also kind of made me realize this is, you know, a few steps away from autonomous from my perspective. And I found that it's really, really difficult to stay focused enough to switch your brain back on in an emergency scenario. Mm-hmm. So to speak, you know, you hear from manufacturers like Tesla, well, it's the driver's responsibility to take control of the vehicle should the vehicle, you know, not be able to handle a certain situation or emergency circumstance, like if the autopilot system fails. The thing is, I checked out when I had my radar-assisted cruise control on.
Your brain went into cruise control as well.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And I don't mean to brag, but I feel like I am a very capable and astute driver, and I don't mean that in a braggadocious manner. I mean that as in a practiced method.
Sure.
I'm very aware of my surroundings, being that I've been in several wrecks before. My career demands it. It's a practice technique. So I like to know what's happening around me as I drive. But if the car tells me that it's got it, I can't help but check out. I'm not going to double check the car on its work. Because in my brain, I trust technology inherently, and maybe that's to a fault. But when the car says, hey, I got this, all right, technology, I'll let you handle this. And I'm not going to be the overbearing parent that's like, well, make sure you do this right. It's not going to understand me anyway, as
right.
most kids don't.
As but, far as the parent part goes, you have to stand over them, make sure you do this.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Or they don't,
oh, yeah.
I'm just saying.
Right. So for a manufacturer to say, hey, you need to be the last line of defense, even with my above average reaction times, I can't imagine the average American stepping in within 2 seconds to react well enough to avoid colliding into a truck or into a person or anything else to that degree. So when it comes to autonomous vehicles, I'm having a lot of trouble figuring out how we're going to progress with that.
I think the objective, I think the end game is going to be if all the cars are autonomous, then it will be less of an issue.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. plus, you know, if they're completely autonomous too, partly autonomous is the discomfort zone. Basically, in my experiences, I've driven a few that have, I think other manufacturers call them adaptive cruise control, maintaining that following distance. And I find them annoying because of two things. One, if someone in front of you is going 15 under, that means you're going to be going 15 under unless you elect to pass. And that's okay because you don't run into the person in front of you. But the annoying part is it doesn't tell you when that's happening. You just kind of at some point say, oh, wait a minute, I'm going pretty darn slow here. So if the thing would beep when it would tell me that it's, you know, backing the speed off to maintain that distance, I would like it more. I have driven some GM vehicles that have the lane thing. I'm not sure what they call it, but they only cut you so much slack on the GM cars. They'll bump you back into the lane, but you have to have a very shallow angle of attack on the boundary of the lane. If you are really steered out of the lane, the car is going to keep going. And after two times, it will give you a big beep and a warning on the dashboard saying, you know, put your hands back on. So I didn't get comfortable enough to really zone out. I still had to babysit it, and that was okay. As long as I have to think about keeping it between the lines, I'm pretty okay with it.
I get Ronnie's point, though. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
It strives to take the human out of the equation,
yeah,
and the human can't get back into the equation in the right amount of time. So
I think it's probably a personal perspective thing, because my perspective is I'm safety conscious enough that I don't want to be caught with my pants down, so to speak.
Yeah.
I'm going to be watching those white lines because my life depends on staying between them.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe, here's my wicked brainstorm, maybe we take bad drivers and just, they're the ones who get relegated to autonomous vehicles and everyone else can still have their independence.
That'd be a start.
And where I would jump up and down and say, yes, please, at the same time, because I've read 1984 too many times, who gets to decide who is the bad driver, who is controlling them and keeping them from going?
You already have the executive branch of law, of government actually decides that you're a bad driver by giving you tickets.
Okay, wrong podcast for that rant. Moving rapidly along. But no, I agree. It's you're either in the zone or you're not in the zone, and trying to jump in and out of that role, I agree, would be difficult, especially in an emergency situation where you need to be focused, not just kind of like waking up. Coming out of cruise, you know, you need to be on your best, and you're not. You're la la la. My car's got it.
Right.
Well, to address the regulation point, I think that's where stricter DMV testing would actually come into play. If you can't
absolutely
score,
there should definitely be, even now, even without autonomous, you know, it should be.
But it would be a great segue, because I feel like the American people in general, when we say, okay, we're going to have stricter testing, people can. I mean, it happened in school for me all 12 of my years. People can complain out of bad grades. And it's like, what? You know, people will do that as adults as well. Like, oh, what do you mean I got a 60? I'm a great driver. And the test says you're not.
The test says
right.
So,
but it's not the end of the world, because you get to have an autonomous vehicle. If you really want independent driving, you still should have that option at racetracks, driving days, et cetera, et cetera. For people like myself that love, you know, good spirited driving on the open road, we would have to pass the test and do our studies and make sure our reflexes are still, you know, where they need to be, as well as our vision.
I agree.
We do it for airplanes.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I had said way back when that licenses should be graded as far as you are this kind of driver, so you are not allowed to use the left-hand lane, or you are allowed to, or you can't even enter the highway, or, you know, grade it on whatever skill you demonstrated when you were testing.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Just to say what kind of driver you are, but, yeah.
Well, while we're on that topic, I want to break a myth down real quick. I was driving with my wife a few weeks ago, and I told everyone on air, and this isn't a new point, I'm pretty darn fast on the road. I cruise around 75 to 80 miles an hour. It's nothing obscene. Mm-hmm. I'm usually in the left lane. I use my turn signals. I give you people plenty of space that are going 20 under in the left lane for some odd reason. And while we were cruising, a motorcycle blitzes by us at around 115 to 120. And my wife goes, well, that guy certainly has a death wish. And that would be the common thought process. The reality is, actually, the faster you go, and if you are skilled and you have the appropriate reaction times, you are safer going faster to pass people than you are just creeping past them. The reason is this. If I'm going 80 miles an hour and someone boogies by me at 120, I don't know it's coming, and it's gone in a second. So if you're driving 40 miles an hour on a street and you pass your parallel parked vehicles, you're going by them because they're standing still and they're gone in a moment. However, if I'm going 80 and a motorcycle tries to pass me at 90 and I'm not paying attention and I switch lanes, that motorcycle's toast. The percentage of accident increases, because if I hear it or see it coming and I panic and I shake my wheel or whatever,
Well, see, that's where I was going to go. If you do a knee-jerk reaction to a car moving in your direction and you're going 115, mm-hmm. the slightest little, you know, jerk of that wheel is going to be multiple times worse and can lead to something. Everything happens so much faster and so much more right. dramatically at those speeds.
Absolutely. But in the instance of the people that you were passing, say I was the person going, you know, 100 plus, if someone decides to start to make a slow move, I can see that from a huge distance away because that's what you need to go fast. You can predict the motions of most drivers, and that's a technique I teach to a lot of people that like to go to advanced driving and the such. There's tells that cars give you whether they're going to do something crazy or not.
And I agree. But I call it auto happens. Body language right. instead of body language. But, and I wish I could find a video mm-hmm. that I'm thinking of from way back when. It was his speed that killed him.
Oh,
and
sure.
it's a very poignant video clip. And, of course, everybody wants to blame the car. But it's clearly visible mm-hmm. that the car is making a turn. But he was going so fast, mm-hmm. he wasn't able to stop. And because of the speed, I guess he assumed he couldn't swerve. So
but
he went head on.
I think we're talking about a couple different things here. Because on the one hand, if you do have the reflexes and the reaction time that makes fast driving feasible, then maybe you're safer doing the faster driving.
But
on the other hand, I'm agreeing with you that you know speed does kill. I would probably wager that if we had a police officers and first responders in this room to weigh in on the issue, they would all say that everyone needs to slow the hell down.
And to nuance on that a little bit, the skill thing is the big if because nobody knows what the skills of those around them are. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, absolute speed is one thing. Difference in speed is another thing. That's why if you're going 80, somebody right. else does not need to be going 120.
That's right.
Well, I will refer to the famous Jeremy Clarkson in the instance of speed kills. It's not really speed that kills. It's suddenly stopping.
Yeah.
But no matter how good the driver, like I was kind of saying, laws of physics still apply. There's only so much good driving can compensate for what's going to happen in certain situations. And it's things you need to be prepared for. And if it's a situation where somebody is a top-notch driver and they want to accelerate rapidly on their motorcycle to pass to avoid, say, that person changing lanes, okay, but maybe not as a consistent speed. Possibly speed applicable to the situation.
And I think that is pretty common amongst most speed drivers. We do it for a couple minutes and then we just get tired and then we go back to cruise. It's usually to get out of the way of very slow people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I've on many road trips, I've come across, you know, cars that I would blitz with. And after maybe 5 minutes of that, once all traffic is cleared up, we're cruising back again at like 70 to 80. But, I mean, if we had Autobahn mentality on our highways, where if we wanted to boogie in the left lane at 120 and everyone was boogieing at 120
in the
left
lane. Well, and that's the other piece that's missing from the American puzzle is that, by and large, our drivers are not disciplined.
Mm. Right.
And that's not a northern thing and it's not a southern thing. It's an American thing. And
Yeah. Inadequately trained and no sense of the common good.
Well, just last night coming home, I saw this guy in a, and we're turning this into a rant again, and I'm a little hesitant to do this, but there was a slow driver in the left lane who was just tootling along, and it was like 10 o'clock at night. It was not heavy traffic. It was like three or four cars on the road, me one of them, and I passed him. You know, I was in the right lane anyway, clear shot. I passed him. About half a mile later, someone behind me is flashing their brights at the slow guy in that little car, and he wouldn't move.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He just wouldn't move. There's plenty of space to move. There's plenty of space to get around. So a number of things happened. One, the guy in the little car sped up, eventually passing me again. And the truck that was tailgating him, the entire way, even though they had half a mile to play with where he could easily have just gone around in the right lane. But I'm like, this is just a perfect vignette of how bad people are about surrendering a lane and just following common rules of courtesy on the road.
And I had one recently who, every time I'd flash my lights, he would give me one blink of his right turn signal while sitting there in the left lane in his little Ford hatchback, whatever it was. Yeah. Like, really? Come on.
Yeah. So, anyway. All right, I think we've beaten that topic to death. But.
Well, on a side note, I will say that when I took my driver's license test, my instructor clapped at me. So I got claps.
Which is better than getting the clap.
Yes, yes, definitely.
If you get that from a driving test, you're clearly doing something wrong.
Exactly.
Ben, can we talk about the Gremlin in 10 minutes or less?
I think so, yeah. We had mentioned it in a previous episode, just in a little, you know, joke in passing kind of thing, but it got me thinking about it.
Yeah.
My aunt and uncle had one of these when I was a little kid. I think it was like a metallic pine green one with an automatic, you know, very dull car. My uncle tended to buy dull cars. But now I started reading up on the Gremlin, and I think, you know, history has kind of dealt it a bum rap. We joke about it today. Yeah, they were a little funny looking. But you know, what I found in my digging made it sound like a lot of the way we treat it today is unjustified.
I think that's right. I think in many ways it was a car that was ahead of its time. But
in some ways it was. And yeah. You know, let's paint the picture here. It was 1970 when it came out.
Right.
The oil crisis hadn't quite hit yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the country definitely had a market for smaller, more efficient vehicles. And you know, this is something that came from the American Motors Corporation, which... give you a quick history of that. AMC, as they're known for short, was a result of a merger in the 50s between Nash Kelvinator and Hudson Motors companies. And, of course, the Kelvinator, Nash Kelvinator, is the one that made refrigerators. They made cars under the Nash, Hudson, and Rambler brands through the 50s. They made nothing but Ramblers in the late 50s or early 60s. Then the AMC name started coming up on some of their products. They came out with a car called the Hornet in 69. Hornet was an old Rambler name. The Hornet platform a year later was shortened, and the Gremlin was built on that shortened platform. And this was a car that was sold as kind of cute and different. It was aimed at a younger market, and something like 60% of the buyers were under 35, so they succeeded there. They made it until 1978, over 671,000 produced in that time. The looks of it came from the kind of inspired by the AMX GT concept car of the late 60s, which I've seen in a museum, and it's a pretty sharp looking little thing. And the funny thing is, the guy who designed it, the idea kind of hit him while he was on a commercial flight somewhere, and he did the first sketch on an airsick bag, which a lot of people will say is strangely relevant because there are a lot of people who don't like the looks of the Gremlin. But it debuted at about $1,900, which would be the equivalent of about $12,000 today.
And which is not bad at all.
No, and it had an impressive option list.
Yeah.
It was one of the first real hatchback cars, and they made an advertising claim that it was America's first subcompact, but that's totally not true. The Crossley of the 40s or the Nash Metropolitan of the 50s really can claim that.
But the Gremlin did hit the was the first, like, I think, like mass-produced hatchback in general.
Yeah, it was the first one that really had that real trapezoidal shape, and it had a rear-opening window as opposed to a full hatch. But, yeah, it had pretty good fuel mileage at the time, despite using 3-liter-plus six-cylinder engines. Good initial quality. They were known for being sturdy. They were fairly tough. A little heavier than their competitors, but it got as good mileage as a VW Beetle while having like 60% more horsepower or something. A few two-seat ones were made in 70 and 71. That option went away. They came out with a V8 one in 72.
V8 Gremlin.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Pause for laughter.
Right? It was a 5-liter V8. And
5-liter V8.
And Gremlin. It was widely acknowledged as the poor man's Corvette. And it was the only thing approaching a muscle car you could get for under $2,200 at the time.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. They also... And in the same year, AMC introduced the auto industry's first 12-month, 12,000-mile bumper-to-bumper warranty. This did a lot of good for the company. They called it the Buyer Protection Plan. It was really the foundation of the warranties we have today. Did lots for their public relations. The following year, they brought out the Levi's package interior option with
Was it made out of jean?
It looked like it. Well, due to fire safety regulations, they couldn't actually use cotton for the upholstery, but they used a spun nylon that looked like denim, and they had the copper rivets and things like that. It was a very popular package. George H.W. Bush actually owned one of those, and George W. drove it when he was in school for his MBA.
That's hilarious.
Bill Clinton had a Gremlin 2 at one point to bring other future presidents into it. They in 76, the V8 was discontinued due to poor sales. They only sold about 40,000 of them in three-plus years.
Better V8 options.
Asterisk.
Yeah. Well, among AMC, yeah, they had some decent ones. But 74 was a bad year for the Gremlin because with the economic stagflation going on, the oil embargo hitting.
Yeah, that was the onset of the fuel crunch and the changing of the cars.
Right. Well, the broader economy had an issue with price inflation coupled with no economic growth, stagnation and inflation, which they called stagflation. and that was the year that the Pacer came out. So all those factors together kind of knocked on the Gremlin a little bit, and the sales slowed down. They tried to deal with the fuel crunch in 77 by making an option for a VW-sourced four-cylinder engine. They didn't sell a lot of those, and it actually didn't really do as well as the sixes did. 79, yeah.
So my question to you then, just to wrap us out here, is that,
right,
are you going to buy one?
No, I'm not, because I did a little looking around on the webs, and this is a car that was taken racing by a few people.
Yeah.
You know, its sturdiness was well known. It got pretty good marks for its handling, despite all the things that it was. But I looked around on the webs to see what's for sale these days. I saw two of them.
Yeah.
I saw two Gremlins for sale.
On eBay.
One was on Hemmings, I believe. This was a very nicely preserved one that had a 401 cubic inch AMC V8 in it.
Wow.
That was a popular swap because it would drop right in.
Yeah.
It bolted right up to the bell housing. It was an AMC engine, no problem at all.
Yeah.
One, a nice cherry red one with the 401 V8 and a few other AMX type options is available now for
$34,000. Yeah.
And then I saw a fairly beat dead stock one for $4,400.
Right.
Well, if you were going to mess around with an engine swap, you obviously wouldn't want the cherry. No matter how pretty it was or what options, if the end goal was to make it a project,
yeah,
then, yeah, you would want the beater.
Oh, sure, yeah. And it was pretty beat. But, you know, by comparison, you can find more Lotus Esprits for sale right now than AMC Gremlins.
So there are two AMC Gremlins on eBay as we speak.
Probably the same ones.
No, one's a 77 AMC Gremlin X with a six-cylinder engine in it for, well, the buyer wants $12,000 for it.
Oh, wow.
And then there's a 1971 version of the car. He says the engine will turn over, but he hasn't actually started it and driven it in many years. So,
in other words, I've tried.
Right.
It's turning over,
Well, the one who wants 12 may get it because they're fairly rare now.
Yeah.
Most of them, like mass-produced everyday cars,
yeah,
went to the crusher, and a lot of the ones that did survive got turned into dirt track racers.
Yep.
If you want to restore one now, you might have trouble with some of the parts.
Yeah.
So they've got kind of a cult following now, but restoration is difficult and good cars are very rare.
Right. This car looks like it's got the 77 one on eBay right now looks like it's got a fresh coat of paint on it. And I would totally rock that. I would totally just buy it and have fun with it.
After reading all this about them, after reading about all these trivial facts about the Gremlin and all the things about it back in its day, I have much more love for them now than I used to.
I agree. I don't think they are really worthy of disdain these days. But
no.
There's a lot of cars like that, though.
Yeah. All right. That takes us to a close for today. That's been a good start. What else do we need to touch on real quick, anybody? Mm-hmm. I guess that's it. Thank you, as always, for joining us. This has been The Thing About Cars, coming to you from Strongbox West in Atlanta. Please find our Patreon. You can always find us on Facebook. And, of course, our website is thethingaboutcars.com. Oh, come see us. We'll actually be recording at the Italian Car Day happening in Norcross. I believe that's March 2. So verify the date, please. But we will actually be there whatever day that is. Probably be recording on site. And still looking forward to going to the Summit Motorama event in April. So keep your eyes peeled for more information on that. And we hope you guys are being safe out there. Stay warm. See you soon.
Goodbye. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.